Penguin Random House Audio presents Why Are We Yelling? The Art of Productive Disagreement. This is the author, Buster Benson. Dedication. To Kellyanne, Nico, and Louie, with whom I have my most enjoyable disagreements. Note. The print version of this book includes illustrations, which you can view on my website at whyareweyelling.com. That's y-r-we-yelling.com. Introduction. Three misconceptions. A weed is but an unloved flower. Ella Wheeler Wilcox. A man is yelling obscenities in his backyard. His neighbor, overhearing this ruckus, walks up to the short fence between their yards and asks if everything is okay. No, everything is not okay, he yells back, before catching his misdirected anger and becoming apologetic. He stands up and tries to shake off his rage. His fists clench giant tangles of pulled weeds, dandelions, sourgrass, and other local varieties that the neighbor recognizes as the scourge of homeowners. The man gestures to his garden. These stupid weeds! How do you keep these pests out? The neighbor can tell that he's given his yard a lot of attention, despite his frustration with it. A beautiful lemon tree grows along the back wall, and a variety of flowering plants offer secondary focal points that pleasantly zigzag across the yard, ultimately returning her eye to the lemon tree. She says, I think you might be pulling them up the wrong way. These plants have long, fragile roots, and their bulbs break off and stay underground. They're sneaky weed hydras. Every time you chop off one head, 12 grow back. Ugh, weed hydras are the last thing I want to deal with right now, the man says. I don't have time to excavate each precious weed one by one. I work all day and just want to come home to a nice yard. I can show you how to do it, the neighbor offers. It can be pleasant work. Also, these weeds you have aren't all bad. They do good things, too. Their long roots bring nutrients up to the topsoil and help hold the soil together during rains. And their leaves make a good salad topping. The man scoffs. Salad's not my thing. Thanks for the offer to help, but no thanks. I'm just going to do what I always do and then move on to more important things. He yanks a few more weeds out and hurls them into the compost pile with an angry force, reminiscent of a knight swinging his sword at a dragon. Maybe I'll just burn the whole yard to the ground. He mumbles under his breath, and he marches back inside. Arguments and weeds are similar in many ways. They sprout in our gardens and minds. We usually don't want them in either place. They're nuisances at best, and mortal enemies at worst. Many of us approach disagreements the same way this man approaches weeds, as things to battle and destroy. This audiobook is about the art of productive disagreement, which requires a shift in mindset akin to the one the man's neighbor tried to suggest. To begin to see it, first we need to remove a few common misconceptions about what arguments really are. Misconception 1. Arguments are bad. They're not bad, but they can be unproductive. We aren't taught how to argue productively. We argue with our alarm clock, which insists we wake up. We argue with our clothes that wear out or stop fitting. We argue with our bodies. We argue with our pets. We argue with bumps in the sidewalk that we almost trip on. We argue with cars in traffic. We argue with our bosses and teachers and parents. We argue with computers and technology. We argue with our friends and relatives. We argue with our spouses and children. We argue with the television. We argue with the sky. We argue with ourselves. And when we sleep, arguments creep into our dreams as well. No wonder we're yelling. It's exhausting. To add insult to injury, when I ask people what they think about the way we argue, 9 out of 10 people classified arguments as unproductive. Why do we argue if it's both unpleasant and unproductive? Despite how pointless they often seem afterward, don't arguments feel unavoidable in the moment? It's true. In the moment, arguments perform a crucial and underappreciated job for us by waving a flag that something important to us is being endangered. Whether it's a personal preference, a hunch about the best strategy for meeting a shared goal, or a core value of ours. This endangerment sparks strong emotions. Often, we notice the emotional buildup and push it back down, waiting for a better time, or telling ourselves that it's not worth our energy. And we advise others to pick their battles wisely, doing everything they can to keep the peace. But if we make a habit of pushing the frustration too far down, sometimes we begin to believe we're at fault for being frustrated, and we beat ourselves up about it. If we do that, the arguments decrease in frequency, but we're left with a constant, low-level anxiety that slowly wears away at our mental and physical health. Today, 1 in 5 adults in the United States has some form of anxiety disorder, and the rate of deaths from the 3 despair-related causes, suicide, drug overdose, and alcohol-related illness, has been increasing for the last decade, causing our average lifespan to actually dip for the first time in decades. Hiding from our negative emotions doesn't make them go away. They'll find some way out, even if it kills us. We need weeds, and we need disagreements too. Famous marriage researcher Dr. John Gottman says that a relationship without conflict is a relationship without communication and is bound to fail. Conflict is inevitable whenever 2 or more people are talking about things from their own unique perspectives. Disagreements are a sign that the relationship's soil is healthy. Gottman recommends a 5-to-1 ratio of positive encounters to negative encounters, because this ensures that the flow of disagreements is kept open and can therefore be resolved without being overwhelmingly negative. And yet, most of us were never taught how to argue. We weren't taught how to navigate negative encounters so that we are able to acknowledge the negative and strengthen the positive. How we argue matters. Luckily, this is a solvable problem. We can learn this skill. But first, how did I end up obsessed with productive disagreement, and why should you listen to me? When my mom asks me every couple of years what I actually do for a living, it's always tough to explain. I've spent the last 20 years as an entrepreneur, engineer, and product leader at high-profile, hyper-growth tech startups like Amazon, Twitter, and Slack. I've worked with engineers, designers, marketers, researchers, data analysts, customer support reps, business leaders, and customers, each with different plates spinning, different anxieties clashing, different incentives to pursue, and different measurements for success. My job has basically been to help facilitate meaningful and productive collaboration within a million ever-changing constraints. At the same time, I've been studying cognitive biases, logical fallacies, and systems thinking, and applying what I've learned to the work I do. In 2016, I published an article titled Cognitive Bias Cheat Sheet, which proposed an analysis and simplification of more than 200 cognitive biases. It went viral and has since been adopted by academics and researchers around the world as a way to reframe cognitive biases. Instead of dismissing them as mental bugs, we should consider that our brains had a very good reason for adopting these shortcuts of thinking. They continue to help us get things done in a world of information overload and scarcity of time and attention. Rather than fighting these shortcuts, our effort will be better spent developing honest bias, which means accepting our own limitations and always remaining open to evidence of our blind spots. This mix of professional and amateur obsessions has been a petri dish for iterating on methods of productive disagreement. I've spent the last few years conducting experiments, both online and in person, to test theories about our existing habits regarding bias and communication, as well as better strategies for managing those biases. This research has persuaded me that the art of productive disagreement is the most important meta skill that anyone can acquire. I've become much more concerned when I see people being too polite and conflict avoidant than when conflict is surfacing and being heard. Hidden disagreements are much worse than surface disagreements. Kim Scott, the author of Radical Candor, calls this impulse towards kindness ruinous empathy, because it actually causes more problems than it solves. It's a real thing that has begun to take hold in our companies, at our dinner tables, and even in our own heads. It happens when people care a lot about things, but for cultural or personality-based reasons, they feel it is best not to challenge them directly. Disagreements are a sign of group health, not pathology. In cultures that allow the airing of grievances in a way that addresses them productively, are more likely to create successful relationships, businesses, and communities. Surprising truth, people are happier and groups are higher functioning when the flow of necessary disagreements is open and they have an honest chance to be heard. Are all arguments the same?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?